Future Proof Extra
with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.
Inflammatory bowel disease, or IBD, is the umbrella term for Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis. It's becoming more and more common, but current treatments do not work in every patient. And attempts to develop new drugs are often unsuccessful because we don't know a huge amount about what causes it. So what is it, and how can we better understand the causes of IBD to help develop better treatments? Well, Colm Collins is assistant professor in the School of Biomolecular and Biomedical Sciences at UCD, and he is a Conway investigator. He joins me now. Colm, this is often a mistake. It's actually a mistake that I made until I ended up doing a bit of work on an IBD event. IBD and IBS are very different things.
Absolutely. So IBS is not an immunological disease. It's typically psychological. And some of the symptoms are the same. Yeah, so some of the symptoms are the same in that patients develop disrupted bowel movements, whether it's elevated levels of motility, and we call that IBS-D, so D for diarrhea, or else they're just not having enough bowel movements, in which case it's IBS-C, which is constipation related.
So this is irritable bowel syndrome.
Sorry, yeah.
Yeah, so very different to IBD, which is...
So IBD is an immune disease. It's, you know, it's more like diabetes or arthritis in that your immune system is attacking your own body, and that's triggering inflammation in your gut. And these are the symptoms like constipation or diarrhea or stomach pain. They're just a side effect of that immune reaction. And the difference, again, between the two conditions is IBS can't be treated with anti-inflammatory drugs, whereas IBD, generally speaking, is controlled to a certain extent with anti-inflammatory medications.
I made the mistake of Googling IBD, and I saw a lot of Google images that then I suppose I was opened to the extreme nature of some patients who live with IBD. Can you talk to me a little bit about how this particular disease is sort of seen as a sort of hidden disease, but actually the effects of it can be quite severe?
Sure. I mean, first of all, just in terms of the hidden nature of IBD in Ireland, imagine you're at the Aviva Stadium or in Croke Park in a couple of weeks watching Leinster versus Munster, right? And you look out over the stadium and you see 40,000 fans in red shirts screaming and shouting when their teams hit the pitch. Like, that's the number of people who have IBD in Ireland. And that's just the people we know about. There's a huge proportion of patients who appear to be undiagnosed or underdiagnosed. And we've seen work from Billy Burke and Seamus Hussey in Children's Hospital looking at the increasing rates of IBD. And Ireland has one of the highest rates of new cases of the disease. So absolutely, it's an underappreciated disease, particularly in Ireland, but also around the world.
But the difference, I suppose, in severity between IBS and IBD, IBS, you know, is uncomfortable and it's difficult to live with and so on, but it is nothing compared to, you know, some of the more severe symptoms of IBD, right?
Absolutely. IBD patients typically get hospitalized at least three times a year, especially early on when they're just newly diagnosed.
For what?
They can develop a range of different complications because of the disease. So, for example, perianal fistulas, where they basically develop a hole that goes right through the bowel and into the outside world. Mm. And obviously, that's hugely problematic. They can develop strictures where there's a tightening of their intestine, means that food can't pass through it. And that has to be surgically removed and resected.
Oh, wow.
So it's incredibly common. I mean, it's funny, if you meet a patient who has IBD, the first thing they'll say is, I've lost, you know, I've had my colon removed, I've lost 4 centimeters of my small intestine, I failed off this therapy and this therapy and this therapy. And yet, they're incredibly positive, incredibly resilient people.
God, I mean, I knew that those symptoms happened. I didn't realize that that was such a common thing to have these sort of surgeries. So it's a chronic condition as well, right? It's not something you have for a little while, you have these surgeries and then it goes away.
Absolutely. So it's a lifelong condition for which we currently have no cure. And what's worse is that it's not just the gut symptoms that are problematic. They get arthritis-like symptoms. You know, you could be a 30-year-old with arthritis, you know, already, where your joints become inflamed, or they can get ocular inflammation in their eye that they then have to deal with, or skin diseases that are there are all of these things that are consequential to the original inflammation that started out in the gut and then just spread everywhere else.
So this is as a result of the immune system attacking its own body, and it sounds like depending on where that happens, or are there different types of cells that are involved in this immune response, and is that why we see you know, like arthritis is obviously a very different condition to, you know, whatever causes a fistula, right?
Yeah, but it's the same immune cells. They're just responding to a different trigger. And so for a long time, we thought that the trigger for patients was a virus or a bacteria that they'd come into contact with at some point in their life.
We've ruled that out?
Absolutely. So there was a paper a couple of years ago by a professor in Oxford named Fiona Perry, who's an absolute superstar in terms of IBD research. And what they proved is that the T cells or the immune cells within our gut are the exact same as a person who has inflammatory bowel disease. What's, you know, in terms of what they respond to, mm-hmm. where the difference comes is how they respond. So whereas our immune cells say, you know, this is something that's non-toxic or not harmful, you know, don't respond, don't react, don't trigger inflammation. In patients who have IBD, their immune cells, when they come into contact, that's something that's relatively innocuous. They say, oh, this is bad. We need to attack this. We need to recruit more cells. We need to, you know, trigger in a huge inflammatory response to deal with a problem that's not actually really there.
So I'm guessing genetics is a large part of this disease.
Yeah, so there's four factors that we think of when we think of IBD, and genetics is certainly one of them. But if you look at twins who are, you know, same DNA, there's only about a 40% likelihood that both of the twins will have IBD. And what's weirder about that is if you look at the two individuals, generally the one that has IBD was also the one who was born first. And we know from other studies that twins who are first born tend to have been better fed in utero. And that's why they were,
really?
Why they're born first. Yeah, so the bigger, they tend to be slightly bigger and they tend to be born first because they're just positionally located in a place that they get better nutrition.
Huh.
And so that's why we think there's a nutrition aspect to this as well. And sure enough, that would also explain why we're seeing this explosion in Ireland, right? So, you know, you go to a supermarket now and you can buy kielbasa or chorizo or salami or, you know, a whole range of different types of sausages. If you went into a supermarket in Ireland in the 80s, your choices were sausages or cocktail sausages, if you're feeling fancy. You know, so that degree of diversity is something that we see in developed countries, but we don't really see that in, you know, sub-Saharan Africa, where the rates of IBD are incredibly low by comparison.
So it's diet?
It's partially diet. And, you know, from an extreme example...
Just say it's one thing, Colm.
It's so much easier if it's just one thing.
I
know, because you could be living in the house with someone else, you're both eating the same diet, you both have similar or very similar genetics, and, you know, that's no guarantee that you'll develop the disease.
What about ultra-processed food? Is that linked in any way? Do we have good quality studies that look at IBD and ultra-processed food?
Yes. So sort of indirect evidence definitely points to that. So, for example, what we call the Western diet. So that's high protein, high fat, and highly processed. We know that that's a trigger for disease. And we know that if you can, people who don't have a diet like that are much less likely to have the disease.
Okay.
So, for example, there was a study by Maria Abreu in Miami who looked at people who'd moved to Miami from Puerto Rico within one generation. And they go from relatively low level of disease incidence to a very, very high level, much more similar to the people around them in Miami.
Yeah.
And we believe that that's because they're getting that, dietary diversity. So it is, and again, the flip side is also true. So if you take a child, and again, this only works in children, if you take a child and you give them an elemental diet, so that's basically stripped out all the fun stuff and just the bare bones nutrition that they absolutely need, and you feed that through a nasal tube or intranasal tube, you can almost completely cure the disease, at least temporarily.
Why don't we do that?
Because it's horrific.
But so is IBD, surely.
Yeah, but you can't get adults to comply with it, and it has to be complete compliance.
And so how long would they have to be on this diet for? Presumably, if it's hard to get people to do it, we don't really have data.
Actually, the reverse is a bigger issue. So if you're on the diet for any length of time, it starts to damage your liver. And so relatively quickly, it becomes, it's difficult for patients to be maintained on it. And so for that reason, it's a great way to put someone into remission. In other words, to, you know, suppress their disease and suppress the inflammation, and then switch them to a more conventional therapy in order, like steroids or something, in order to maintain them on that.
So someone is having a flare-up, so to speak, you basically cut out all the nonsense, you get them to a stable level, and then you can give them other treatments that they might be more tolerant of.
Exactly.
Right, okay. And by the way, if you Google what ultra-processed foods are, like, it's very upsetting. It's flipping everything. It's everything. Like, we think, I was like, you know what, we do quite well. We got fruit and vegetable. I looked at ultra-processed fruit. I was like, oh, come on. How is that ultra-processed? Everything we eat practically is ultra-processed. We think we're so much better than America. And we are in many ways. But there is lots of stuff out there that you might not think is ultra-processed, but it is. Like bread, like white bread. So what do we do in Ireland? What should we be doing to address these sort of things? I mean, obviously diet is one thing. We can't do much about our genes.
Right. So yeah, environment, we can't do an awful lot about that either. I mean, obviously, you know, so we see differences between urban and rural IBD susceptibility. So if you live in an urban area, you're more likely to develop it. And so that's because you don't have the same control over your food. Unfortunately, there's not a lot we can do without doing more research.
Right. If it's nothing to do with bacteria or viruses, does that mean that playing with the bacteria or viruses in our gut and improving our microbiome is not going to affect the outcome of IBD patients?
No, not at all. Because so we have what's called an epithelial barrier. So that's the single cell thick layer that keeps all the bacteria out and keeps our immune system in.
Yeah.
Within the gut. And so bacteria are able to cross that barrier. And if they do that, they trigger inflammation. And that's obviously not what we want. And so we know for a fact that patients who have IBD have a very different makeup in terms of their bacteria compared to somebody who doesn't have the disease. We don't know for sure if it's a cause or if it's a consequence of that inflammation.
Are we about to talk about fecal transplants?
We can do if you want.
Is that like transferring someone's stool to someone else's gut? That is,
it's effective in about 20% of patients,
and it's a treatment for IBD.
It can be, absolutely.
Right. Okay.
So the way that works is you take someone's microbiome, so from a donor, typically someone who's lean, because obviously, if you take it from an obese person, then you can trigger obesity in the recipient, and you don't want that.
Can you?
Yeah, absolutely.
What?
Yeah, absolutely.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, I think I saw something about mice. They did that to mice.
Yeah. So they did it to mice first, they did it to mice, but only because they had seen this phenomenon in humans. When the whole concept of FMT or fecal material transplant or fecal microbiome transplant, when the whole concept was introduced, it was a nightmare from the FDA in terms of regulating who could be a donor.
Right.
You know, they didn't want to have, a generic bank of donors because they said, well, you know, what if they have a disease that we haven't screened for? Mm-hmm. You know, we don't want this to turn into another blood transfusion, you know, scandal. And so the solution was, you ask one of your siblings. And what happened was an obese sibling donated to a lean sibling and the lean sibling became obese. And that's kind of what triggered the studies to look into this in more detail and say, is this a legitimate phenomenon?
Wow.
I mean, since then, things like how fast you can run, your ability to play music. You know, there's a whole range of different things that have been linked to microbiome
don't
transfer.
Don't buy that. No, I don't buy that. That's BS.
But I'll tell you something else, right? So at a very much more simplistic level, there was a researcher in North Carolina called Balfour Sartor. And Balfour demonstrated that if you took a mouse that had no bacteria whatsoever, and you started returning individual strains of bacteria into the mouse, depending on which strain you add, you could change where their inflammation would develop after the fact. Suggesting that there is a direct link between the bacteria and the inflammation.
The Chinese were onto this very early. Have you heard this story? The Chinese were convinced that you could, you know, transfer health benefits through fecal transplant, but they did it orally, and it was called yellow soup. That's a true story. There you go.
Like, you can take capsules. So these are small tablets of compressed fecal material.
Should we have put out a warning?
Talking.
We're all, I mean, I was going to say we're all adults. Not necessarily. And actually, the children would probably love it. So sorry, look, if you're having your lunch, maybe next time. So you can have capsules that contain but don't they get, if you swallow a capsule, doesn't it, it's hard to get material into the gut?
Absolutely. So they need to be enterically coated. In other words, so that they survive the very low, the acidic, low pH environment within the stomach in order for them to continue on down to the colon.
Okay. Very, very interesting. If you're someone who lives with IBD, love to know like how it affects your day to day. You can tell us your stories. We'll get them in the podcast. It's in the News Talk app powered by Go Loud. Colm Collins is assistant professor in the School of Biomolecular and Biomedical Science at UCD and Conway investigator. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Future Proof Extra
with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.